Welcome back to This Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle. I'm your host, Sunny Bunch. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg and Peter Suderman. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
Oh, I'm thrilled.
I'm so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
All right, so Brave New World, folks. Longtime listeners will remember that this show actually began way back in 2019. We brought it over to the Bulwark when I joined that site in 2020. I'm still at the Bulwark. I haven't gone anywhere. But this show was always kind of a weird fit there. And the powers that be ultimately decided it wasn't a fit that really worked. So we, with the help of the tech folks at Substack and the tech folks at the Bulwark, we have spun this thing off entirely into its own separate entity. For lots of you, nothing really is going to change. If you listen via Apple Podcasts, this feed is still going to be there, pumping out episodes. Though I do think starting next week, we're going to move the release date on the free episodes to Wednesday to give maybe people who are paying just a little extra reason to sign up. And then we'll have the bonus episodes every Thursday for the paying members. Ability to comment, first heads up on live events. So many benefits for signing up at movieaisle.substack.com. For those of you who subscribe to us through the Bulwark Substack, you're going to have to sign up again. That's the long and the short of it. We didn't want to transfer over the whole Bulwark subscriber list for obvious reasons. You'll need to proactively sign up. It'll be worth it. It'll be worth it. We're going to be doing some video stuff. We're going to have video, hopefully, of this very thing that I'm talking about right now. I'm looking at myself in the camera. We're going to have video. And Alyssa's going to be doing some writing for the Substack occasionally, I believe, where you're going to have the Tuesday and Thursday episodes. Like always, it should be a fun time. So anyway, go remember movieaisle.substack.com. Go sign up there and we will move on to your regularly scheduled episode. On to the segment that's usually controversies and controversies. This week, though, we're doing instead a little tribute to Diane Keaton, who died over the weekend at age 79. She was one of the few actresses in Hollywood who really got to age more or less naturally, right? From youthful ingenue to adult woman to grandmother. I myself first remember seeing her as the mom in Father of the Bride, right? That movie came out when I was, I don't know, 11 or 12 or so. And she was like, she was just like kind of a cool mom, right? She was nice and everybody liked her and she was like kind of full of life. And she wasn't the main, it is the father of the bride, not the mother of the bride, but she, you know, she was pretty good in that. Around the same time, you know, you had First Wives Club and Something's Gotta Give and The Family Stone. She had become kind of like this matriarchal figure of Hollywood. It wasn't until some years later when I really started getting into movies and, you know, like, diving deeper into the history of film, that I got to her earlier works, right? The stuff that she did as a younger woman, The Godfather Part One and The Godfather Part Two, obviously, is a major text here. And she has a role in that that nominally is kind of thankless, right? She's Michael's put upon girlfriend and then wife. She's very frequently more reactive than proactive. But Keaton's work as Kay is immensely important to that film. Like, first off, she serves as the audience surrogate. Yes, she is bringing us into the crime family with an outsider's perspective. But she does something else, something that's harder and more important, in that she kind of serves as the moral center of the movie without being an innocent herself, at least. Yes. You know, at first she is kind of an innocent, right? She is going with Michael to this wedding and it's all very weird and she doesn't understand what's happening on. But by the time she's married to Michael, she knows what business he's in. She knows what he does. And by the time she's had his children, she knows what the price of that business is, that sometimes there's an occasional volley of bullets through your bedroom windows, right? We, the audience, are implicated in her corruption because we spend the whole movie really identifying and empathizing with the Corleones. You know, whether or not that's good or bad, whether or not it's intended or not, that's what we do. It's the American dream as nightmare, but we all want the American dream. And she is, in some ways, our guide through it. And then there's her work with Woody Allen and Annie Hall in Manhattan, which are two of the best romantic comedies ever made. There's this kind of ongoing effort to write Allen and his movies out of the history of cinema. And that's too bad, because those are classics for a reason. As the titular titular character in Annie Hall, Keaton served as the prototype for the archetype that would become known as the manic pixie dream girl. But she's more than that. She's not just the manic pixie dream girl, right? She's a woman with her own hopes and desires, and a goddamn fashion icon. You know, you still see women rocking the slacks, vests, bowler combo some 50 years later. And in Manhattan, I think Keaton's character goes a long way towards showing why Alan's stand-in character is so absurd to be infatuated with a teenager. But maybe we don't need to get into that. Alyssa, what did you make of Diane Keaton? What did you think when you heard that she had died?
I was both sad because she was an actress who I think has given you know, women who write about movies an enormous amount, but also just felt like, God, what a life well lived. And I think that you are right to signal out her work in The Godfather, and I want to come back to that for a minute. But I think that Keaton's career provided one really useful sort of heuristic for what it means to be a movie star, which is that where she led, you would follow. And in particular, where she led in terms of liking a man in a movie, the audience would inevitably follow, right? Woody Allen is not your typical romantic comedy lead, shall we say, right? and that was true even before all of the Woody Allen of it all. Because she liked him in the movies where they played opposite each other, you could see like Alvy Singer as a romantic hero. You could see why a woman would be attracted to him, right? But that was also true in a movie like Something's Gotta Give, where Jack Nicholson's character is, abrasive and difficult and sexist, and also dating Keaton's character's daughter. And yet you end up sort of affiliated with Keaton's charm, and also seeing, you know, you end up seeing Nicholson's character through Keaton's eyes in a way that makes him more compelling. And then in The Family Stone, you know, she is so believable as the sort of center of gravity of a family, but also you do get to see sort of the full life cycle of a woman through her character in that movie, right? I mean, there's a scene where, you know, she's being intimate with her husband. You can see her mastectomy scars. And it is simultaneously sort of sexy and sad and ennobled in a way. The Family Stone, I think, was sort of received with a lot of confusion when it was released, but I do not know that I've ever seen anything like that scene on film. And her ability to carry it off was tremendous. But I want to loop back to The Godfather because I really do think, you know, not only is that kind of an urtext for anybody, particularly our age who, and, you know, the generation before us who likes film, but I do think it's kind of an urtext of Keaton. And I wanted to ask, have either of you read the Mario Puzo novel from which it's adapted?
No.
Okay. I have both watched The Godfather a lot because it is sort of a sacred text in my husband's family. But I read the novel after he and I got together. Like I didn't see The Godfather until I started dating my husband. Right. And there is definitely a sort of running joke in our family. Like my family K, it's, you know, it's my family K, it's not me, in which I am K. But Puzo's novel has a lot of subplots and scenes that are cut out, particularly about women. There's a whole subplot in the movie about the bridesmaid from Connie Corleone's wedding, who Sonny is having an affair with. There was a lot more about sort of Mama Corleone, about Apollonia, but there's also just a lot more about Kay that doesn't quite make it into the movie. And among other things, you know, yes, she is sort of naive when it comes to Michael's family, sort of Michael's father in particular, and the men who surround him. But she's not an innocent person, right? I mean, she is someone who, in the aftermath of World War II, is having a sexual relationship with someone she's dating. You know, they're checking into hotels as a married couple. You know, Michael is sort of impressed by her sexual avidity, but also her ability to kind of separate from her parents, you know, very sort of stern Puritan New England values. And there are a number, like there's a scene where the cops sort of confront her at her parents' house. And a lot of that gets cut out of the movie, but Keaton brings all of that text sort of into the performance, right? And, you know, Sonny, I thought, you know, your write-up of her work in that movie really captures how strong her character's, you know, sort of liveliness and courage, but also ultimately sort of moral corruption are in that movie. Again, you know, whether or not I think the people who lionize the Godfather know it, they follow where she leads. And I think that is just a way of sort of defining stardom that is not always flashy. It's often in some ways quite female, and that Diane Keaton really embodied.
Yeah. Peter, I know you said you didn't have a ton of thoughts on Diane Keaton, but what was it about which of her movies is your favorite? Let's just go there.
So I first encountered her in The Godfather, which was a family film in my household. It was one of the very few, along with the Blues Brothers, weirdly enough, that like when everybody at the point that all of my siblings were old enough, when everybody wanted to watch a movie together and no one could agree, you watched The Godfather every now and then, The Godfather 2 or the Blues Brothers. And that's what it was. But the film I associate her with most of all, before any others, is Annie Hall. And in Annie Hall, she created, yes, it was the template for the manic pixie dream girl, what became, you know, that idea. But it wasn't the manic, it wasn't the sort of the shallower, sillier sort of, you know, one note version of the manic pixie dream girl. It was the ideal of the urban woman that you could go and meet and who might fall in love with you, even if you were a nerd who looked like Woody Allen. And in some ways, I want to say, like, she sort of ruined things for a lot of guys, not ruined, but right. Gave a lot of guys like a kind of a false hope, but that's actually wrong. Like she didn't give a lot of guys a lot of false hope. I think what she did was she actually embodied the ideal for a certain type of guy who understood that, hey, she helped them understand. I think that movie, like when I think back about it, that movie helped me understand that part of what I wanted in someone who I was going to date, in someone who I was going to be interested in after moving to Washington, D.C. to work in journalism and think tanks was I wanted somebody who was, first of all, really smart, who was maybe also kind of quirky, maybe all of these other things. But there was this. Like, whatever else you want to say about Woody Allen and his predilections, he wrote a character who was clearly a big part of why she was attractive in that movie was because she was quick. She was intelligent. She was the kind of urban professional girl that a certain type of guy would gravitate towards. And that is a very rare thing. And it's actually not the manic pixie dream girl, which is just the sort of woman who waltzes into your life and has a bunch of feelings just and she's quirks, up and she's down. Right. And maybe she's a little, you know, has some kind of intellectual interests, but isn't that, isn't fundamentally an intellectual person. And what she did was she showed that you could, that like she created an intellectual character who was also sexy and attractive, but also sweet and naive and funny. And she kind of, this is a really hard thing to do as a performer, to combine all of those attributes. And she did it in a way that wasn't just, oh, that's good in one movie. She did it in a way that I think made a lasting impression on cinema and maybe on a lot of men, or at least me.
Yeah, she did this thing throughout her career where she was like smart and funny, but also kind of silly and like quirky, but also just like full of life. Yes. And that's why,
vivacious.
When I saw she had died, I was like, oh wow, she's so young. But you know, she's almost 80. Like it's not like she was young. She just always seemed young, and always seemed, or not even young, just full of life. Like, and that is you know, that's not every actor has that for certain. That is not a universal skill. And it is something that she managed to do and do throughout the years. Again, it never felt silly when she was like having a little bit of a, you know, a tiff or a fit or something in one of her later movies. And she was older. It always fit her perfectly. And that is that, again, that's not something everybody has.
I actually slightly disagree with this. There were times when it did feel silly, but it didn't feel shallow. And that's the difference. And that's the thing that she was able to pull off. She was able actually to be quite light and quite silly. I think silly is the right word. The lobster scene is a silly sequence. She is being silly, but it is a kind of joyous silliness in which she is connecting with another person over the absurdity, the enjoyable absurdity of a frantically silly life. And that she was able to put that on screen and make it and give it depth, not just a kind of momentary, you know, sort of chuckle.
Like that. Yeah, she was a bridge.
Real talent.
She was a bridge in a lot of ways between the screwball era and sort of raunchier romantic comedies.
That's exactly right.
Where, you know, the screwball tradition is silly, but often sort of formal, right? Like the silliness comes out of formality. Like if you look at The Lady Eve, you know, that is a movie where it's a ridiculous scenario played within a set of elaborate social conventions. And she, in many of her best movies, represents the sort of the more naturalistic the more naturalistic cinema of the 70s, but also the sort of the looser social mores. But she always had, you know, it's kind of a core dignity and sense of control that is not what you get in a movie like Bridesmaids or Spy. It's not what you get in, you know, the sort of neurotics without the sophistication of the romantic comedies of sort of the early aughts, and without the sort of Judd Apatow inspired raunch. And that's
and also a real human depth.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's a lovely space to be in.
She wasn't playing a cartoon character.
No, she was always playing, a person.
Right. Even when she was very funny and she could be very funny, she always, even in her lesser movies, always met the test that I have, you know, talked about a zillion times on the show, which is, can you imagine this character off screen when they're not in the movie? And this was never a question with her. You of course you could. You knew exactly what this person was going in any of her roles, exactly what she was doing off screen.
All right. RIP Diane Keaton. Very sad. We will be missed. It's funny. I was going to rewatch The Godfather Saturday night after I got home. But by the time I got home, I got kids. It's like 8:30. That was probably not going to happen. All right. So before we get to the tease for the bonus episode, Peter, Alyssa, you guys wanted to say a little bit about why we're striking out on our own here rather than just letting this thing die, because that's the thing that could have happened. We could have just been like, do we need this? I don't know. What do you want Never. Folks to know about this little community that we have built and are continuing to build?
So we're striking out on our own because we think this thing is important. Sorry, Alyssa, do you want to go ahead?
No, you go first. You go first.
And partly we think it's important because we think it's fun. It's just a delight to talk to my friends every week. And it's a delight to talk to other people who are delighted in conversation. But here's the thing that I think about this show. There's no comp for this show. There's no other show that does what we do here. And our premise is that people who have wildly different political beliefs in particular, but maybe even in some cases moral beliefs about the world, can and should be friends and should find ways to talk to each other. And that one of the ways that you can do that is that you can talk about art. And you can talk about art through a political lens. Yes, you don't ignore that it's about politics, that politics is relevant in art and sort of always represented. At the same time, you're fundamentally interested in art first as an artistic object. And this is what I love about talking to you guys. And this is just not something that you get in... There are plenty of people who will talk about movies and can tell you everything about the history of, this particular camera has been used only in these 17 films, and that stuff's great. And then there are plenty of people who will talk about movies and they'll talk about the politics of movies. And mostly that's people who agree with each other on politics. And they're not really talking about the art. They're not really talking about how movies are made. And what I love about talking to you guys and what I love about our listeners and when I meet when I've met folks who listen to the show at our live shows is it's people who want to talk about art for art's sake, but also understand politics is part of life and people have different views and that's okay.
Yeah. And I think that one thing I'm excited about with this moment, and first, I want to thank the Bulwark. They, you know, everyone at the Bulwark has been just fantastic for us over the years in terms of providing infrastructure for live shows, producing support, which we're now taking on ourselves, which is one of the reasons that we're asking you to chip in if you feel like you can. But it struck me that this was a moment where we could serve all of you better, right? You know, Peter and I see a movie together almost every week when we're in the same town, and we wanted to find more ways to do that with some of all y'all sometimes. And so if you sign up for our paid tiers, you will get the opportunity sometimes to just meet up with us and see a movie. It gave us a chance to hop in when there's big breaking news in the industry. So you will be able to, you know, we'll go live on Substack sometimes and you'll be able to see us do that. And it also, frankly, at a moment of transition in my career, gives me a place to put some of the writing and thoughts that I wasn't getting to share elsewhere. And so I will be writing for the Substack sometimes. But also, I really just want to emphasize, like, we have enjoyed the conversation that we've had with each other, not just for the 6 years we've been doing this podcast, but for what, 6 years before that. And we want to find ways to bring all of you into that more, and give you ways to do that that don't just involve bugging me or Sunny or Peter on Twitter. So among other things, if you have questions, if you have requests, if you have comments, you can email us at acrossthemovieaisle@gmail.com. And maybe you'll get some mailbag episodes if you chip in there. So thank you so much for coming along for the ride with us. I cannot tell you just what a joy it is to have this conversation every week and then to hear from so many of you who are listening at home. So thank you very much. And yeah, here's to the next 6 years.
6 more years. All right. Make sure again to swing by movieaisle.substack.com for our bonus episode on Thursday. Gonna have a bonus episode. We're gonna talk about the Tron series. We're gonna discuss why Disney keeps trying to make this into a franchise by reliving the first one through the eyes of Alyssa, who had never seen it before this week somehow, because it's raised in a barn by monks in the mountains of Sicily. I don't understand what's going on with her life. But now on to...
Just not a big Bruce Boxleitner fan.
Nobody is. On to the main event. Tron Ares. In some ways, Tron Ares is almost a direct sequel to 1982's Tron rather than 2010's Tron Legacy, at least when it comes to the plot and the characters we follow. Spiritually, though, I feel like it owes much more to Joseph Kosinski's 2010 film for reasons I'll explain in a moment. I'll get to that in a minute. Okay. So like I said, Tron Ares basically treats Tron Legacy as if it doesn't exist, with the very brief mentions of Kevin Flynn's son and a tease for a sequel that's never going to happen. Set in the present day, the new NCOM CEO is Eve Kim. She's played by Greta Lee. She's somewhere very cold. We see her somewhere very cold. She's trying to track down some sort of secret program hidden away by Kevin Flynn, who was played by Jeff Bridges in the original and is reprised here for a scene or two. The program is key to permanence, which will allow programs brought from the grid to exist in our real world. Brought how? Great question. 3D laser printers, I guess. It's magic.
Lasers.
They come to our world via magic. That's how everything in Tron works. What you have to understand is that everything in Tron works via magic. There's no technology here. It's just spells and incantations. All right. Julian Dillinger is the CEO of Dillinger Systems. He's the grandson of the original film's villain, Ed Dillinger, who was played by the great David Warner. He is using computer magic to bring AI programs, which again are just magical beings, into the real world. Tanks and also that sort of stuff too, but really soldiers. He wants to bring soldiers and programs that resemble people and are powered by artificial intelligence. Ares, who is played by Jared Leto, is one such program, and he's the ultimate weapon, except that he and his cool-ass vehicles can only exist in our world for 29 minutes. Kim finds the secret to permanence, of course, otherwise there would be no movie. Dillinger decides to kidnap her into the grid and then kill her to dispose of the evidence, which sparks a crisis of conscience in Ares, who saves her and helps her escape. There's a lot of stuff about soul searching and Depeche Mode, weirdly. What does it mean to be human? It's all quite dumb. And worse than dumb, it's often quite boring because the movie fundamentally misunderstands what's interesting about Tron. And that is not the real world. Moving all the action outside of the grid and into the real world is stupid. The real world is boring. The grid is interesting. The movie simply does not seem to understand that. We spend way more time than we should in a Honda Civic. And we spend a lot of Tron Ares in a Honda Civic, folks. Anyway, the movie, again, functionally exists outside of any continuity of the series from Tron Legacy, but it owes a lot to Tron Legacy. Because Tron Ares is, like Tron Legacy, best understood not as a motion picture, a feature film, but as a feature-length music video. Legacy was a feature-length music video for Daft Punk. Ares is a feature-length music video for Nine Inch Nails. And I will, I'll say that occasionally, I saw this in an IMAX press screening. It was almost empty except for the press, and it's in the IMAX sound system, so it sounded really good, and by good, I mean loud. And I would catch myself kind of occasionally bouncing in my IMAX chair when the light show was going on and the music was happening. But that was way too rare. Like, literally, I can count on two fingers the number of times that happened. The movie just never keeps the momentum going. It's just like a couple of great sequences and then stop. We're in a Honda Civic. And I'm going to say this, and I'm not saying this specifically to annoy Peter Suderman. But I will annoy Peter Suderman. And I'm just going to say that, like, the Daft Punk score is a million times better than the Nine Inch Nails score. Like, Daft Punk's music and mood fit the world of Tron much better than Nine Inch Nails does. This soundtrack is fine, but I'm probably not going to download it and play it in my car as I'm driving around places. It's just not that good. Right, Peter?
This is wrong. This is at least mostly wrong because I have already downloaded the Nine Inch Nails soundtrack. I downloaded it a month ago when the full thing was released. The lead single I probably listened to 50 times this summer when it came out. Just gave me a huge pun. I loved it. It's so good. And the only way in which you are correct is that the Daft Punk sequence in the bar in Tron Legacy is much better as a sort of Tron-based techno music video than anything we get here, just because it's better shot and better edited and makes better use of the Daft Punk characters and soundtrack than anything in this movie, which is, I think, yes, the best way to justify this is as a feature-length Nine Inch Nails music video with Tron-inspired videos, right, visuals. And it works well enough on that front just because I think the soundtrack is so good. And because the visuals are occasionally kind of interesting. The effects work in this film. The cinematography is actually quite good. We complain about bad CGI in this podcast all the time. I think the CGI, when you see it, is actually quite effective here. There is a really amazing, just like perfect shot of one of these bridge ships, the Recana,
The Recognizers, Jesus.
The Recognizer flying across the San Francisco Bay, right?
You don't know what a Recognizer is? Fake Tron fan.
Fair enough, right? And it's floating across San Francisco Bay towards the city, and it's just like, oh, that's what it would look like. It looks great. So I'm like, those are the things that work about this movie.
It and looks idiotic. It looks great. Awesome. The whole thing looks idiotic.
And it looks awesome. And in fact, I actually slightly disagree with some of your praise of this film. There's really only one great sequence in it, one that really works on its own terms. And that's the motorcycle chase through, I guess, San Francisco and the streets of it in the middle of the movie.
I think it's Seattle, really, isn't it in Seattle?
Is it Seattle? Seattle was the last one. Maybe it is Seattle.
It might be Puget Sound. I think it's Puget Sound.
I have no idea. Yeah, somewhere on the West Coast.
Fake Pacific Northwest fan.
Yeah, I don't even know. Wherever it is, whatever city, there's some water, there's some tall buildings, and they run the motorcycles through the city. And
that's
it's great. It's great. It's 4 or 5 minutes. It's the best 4 or 5 minutes of the movie. And if the whole movie had been like that, it would have been a pretty good movie. But the whole movie is not like that. And this is, I think, where I disagree with you, Sonny, that, like, in fact, the best sequences in this film are when the Tron world, the grid, comes into the you know, our real world. This movie doesn't work in the grid at all. None of the stuff in the grid is worth caring about. None of it makes any kind of sense. It's almost impossible to follow, even if you've seen the previous films. It's just totally incoherent and kind of secondary. This movie was absolutely the result of a pitch in which somebody was like, just imagine the recognizer flying across the bay. Just imagine those light cycles shooting through downtown streets. And that's it. They just had some cool visual ideas and then wrote a script to try and justify it. And the script is unbelievably bad. It's shockingly bad. Scene by scene, beat by beat, as a story, it's just totally incoherent. Nobody talks like a person. Nobody acts like the paper thin characters. It's totally incoherent. And this whole thing just needs forget the story part. What worked about the original Tron and what both of the sequels have basically left aside was that the original Tron understood that the grid, the computer world that was based on felt like a video game, was a world. And there is so much kind of fun, cool, nifty of its era world building. All of the kind of computer lingo from the early mid 80s that makes its way into the dialogue. It's a little cheesy, sure. It's kind of forced, but it also tells you that, like, this is somebody, like, the screenplay to that movie really made an effort to incorporate the ideas of how computing works into the characters, into the setting, into the structure of that world. It understood in the early and mid to mid 1980s that computers were going to create worlds that people were going to live in. It was incredibly prescient on that front and actually built out that world. And that's why Tron, like, became a kind of minor classic, I think, because it understood that computers weren't just, we're going to do some math, or you're going to type, or maybe they'll spit out some visuals every now and then. Computers are going to be the place that we live virtually. Tron got there first, basically before any other movie, and got it more right than any movie.
Let's save this for the bonus episode.
Until The Matrix. So this is why people are still going back to Tron. We can talk about this more in the bonus episode. But
we'll save this for the bonus episode. Hold on. Peter, stop. Stop talking. The computers, you say computers were going to build a world, but that's the problem with this whole movie, the whole series, really, is that it's not computers building a world, it's people building a world. People build worlds in the internet. The computers don't build a world in the internet. It's like when I say that this movie series treats computers like magic, like, that's what I mean. Computers don't do anything. People do things. But I think you're right. The best sequence in the movie does take place in Seattle. That's great. And if the whole movie had been kind of like that, it could have been
San Francisco, whatever.
Passable. Is it San Francisco? I don't know.
It's probably Seattle. Do they actually say in the movie? I was thinking the whole time, which city is this? It's clearly a West Coast city that has a big body of water.
All right, I'll figure that out here while Alyssa goes. Alyssa, what did you make of Tron, Ares?
Can I ask you about the question? Did it seem like Greta Lee was doing a weird voice in this movie?
No.
Maybe, like, I never want to be the person who's just like, I just hate her voice. But, like, it seemed like she was
No, I will say. There were a couple of times where I noticed some weird ADR. And maybe that's what you're picking up on. There's a lot of ADR in this movie.
Yeah, there was just something very strange about her voice. There were many things that I disliked about this movie, but it was also just very frustrated going from seeing Greta Lee in past lives to seeing Greta Lee in this movie. It was irritating. I did not like it. The script is bad. The, like, sort of silliness about her relationship with her sister could have been, like, Greta Lee could play that story incredibly well with a radically different script. And so that was just a minor thing that constantly irritated me throughout the movie. It's like, why is Greta Lee in this movie? Why is Greta Lee doing this in this movie? But
because
I think
Disney had $140 million budget, or $180 million.
I'm asking the existential questions, Peter. I don't want your logistics. Fine on your logistics.
Also because you both overrate past lives, but that's neither here nor there.
No, we're both right about this.
Yeah, we're both right about this. John McGarro is like John McGarro forever. Anyway, you're the worst. But there were many things that irritated me about this movie. But one of them, and one that I think is sort of more substantial, is that this is yet another movie that has kind of nothing to say about AI. And what it has to say about AI is the least interesting things that it could possibly say, right? Because one of the things that you could have done in this movie is play out the different scenarios we are seeing for sort of AI doomerism and optimism, right? Because Jodie Turner Smith's character, and I think Jodie Turner Smith is not good in this movie and is often not good in the kind of like sort of quasi fascist role she ends up being asked to play. But she plays a character who, you know, fundamentally represents a kind of concern about, you know, the way we're prompting and training AI, right? Like she's effectively a version of the paperclip problem, where if you tell an AI that's like its, you know, its highest function is to produce paperclips, the theory is that it would like turn the entire world into a paperclip factory, right? Like
this is a very generous reading of this character, who I just saw as a computerized bad guy.
Yes. Well, let me be generous for a minute just to play out the idea. You know, she is an AI who's effectively given a prompt that is sort of absolutist, not clearly thought out, does not have guardrails, and like kind of goes rogue as a result. And Ari's is more, you know, kind of represents the idea that like if you are nice to AI, maybe it won't kill you, right? Like Greta Lee's character, who like Evie, is that what her name is? I remember so little. Yeah, it just
demonstrates empathy.
Yeah, she demonstrates
empathetic response is the thing that flashes up on Ari's Terminator screen.
Yes, Ari's like notices that she has an
on all of us.
Ari's notices that, you know, despite having tried to kill her, she has Eve has like an empathetic response when he disintegrates at a 29-minute mark. And he becomes sort of curious about her and then curious about humanity and discovers the musical stylings of Depeche Mode. And ultimately decides that he wants to like live out his life by going to Italy. Right. And there's this sort of, there is one sort of theory of all of this that like, if you're nice to the AI, maybe it won't kill you. Right. And it's like, I have some of that impulse too. Like whenever I interact with chatbots, like I thank them, I try to be polite, right? Like I understand that like that actually is probably like a total waste of memory and will do nothing to keep me from being enslaved by Rocco's basilisk. But, I just sort of do it anyway because I kind of can't resist. But the movie lacks what, to my mind, is the most interesting interpretation of AI, which is the version that decides that humans are just incredibly boring, right? And the only movie that he's even come close to getting this is Spike Jonze's Her, in which Scarlett Johansson's character basically becomes, as she becomes more intelligent, she is no longer satisfied with sort of a single human companion, right? Like she becomes too expansive for this. And this is a movie that lacks AI, that's sort of truly an alien. And, you know, if there was a rationale for a Tron movie in 2025, especially one that explores sort of AI and the idea of programs becoming autonomous and becoming into the world, it should be one that has some interesting competing ideas about AI. But instead, it's just incredibly sort of generic and predictable. Like the robot who like becomes weirdly fascinated with like some aspect of human culture is like, it's such an old joke. And like, Peter, you said something about, you know, the Depeche Mode thing being because Trent Reznor loves Depeche Mode. Is that what this is? Okay, fine. But like,
yeah,
the movie ends up talking about five Depeche Mode references in the script. It's a lot, right?
Yeah, once you get to the end of the second act, there's a really strange and surprising amount of discussion about Depeche Mode. And it's
It's pretty weird. It's about the only way in which the screenplay distinguishes itself as not obviously being written by AI. I mean, every line that isn't about Depeche Mode is basically like, bring me the good guys. I am the bad guy. I want to kill them because I am bad. Right. Like, it's like that level of dialogue. And then you get these like kind of a little bit clever, almost charming. I mean, definitely not. Okay. Almost charming. Let's go with almost charming, not charming. To be clear, we did actually cross the threshold into charming, but almost charming discussions about Depeche Mode in a Honda Civic for the like 10 minutes at the end of the second act. And then he brings that into the grid world when he meets Jeff Bridges, who has absolutely decided not to play Jeff Bridges from Tron and instead just decided to show up as the dude from Big Lebowski but in hologram form. I do not understand.
Maybe being turned into a hologram makes you the dude from the Big Lebowski. You thought about that?
Can I offer,
I think being
one...
Jeff Bridges and being old makes you the dude from Big Lebowski.
Yeah. Well, he's doing the same thing in Tron Legacy, too. So I will. Can I offer one possible suggestion for the Depeche Mode digressions? Jared Leto is also the producer on this movie, and he was very intimately involved in the production. Like, he shepherded this. This is, in some ways, it's Jared Leto's baby. And I would bet $100. If I could get confirmation from somebody on the production, this would be great. I would bet $100 he demanded to have the Depeche Mode stuff in there, because, as you know, he's a great singer and has a wonderful band, 30 Seconds to Mars. It's one of the great musical acts of our time. They have cult meetings on islands in the ocean. So, like, it's these. You look it up. Look, I'm not making anything up about Jared Leto right now. He's,
I trust you. Great. I believe you.
What, he's a million times. Honestly, if this is so, and here's my second hot take, which is that if this movie had a 30 Second to Mars soundtrack, it would be so much better than the Nine Inch Nails soundtrack. Could you imagine how much
would
Jared
Ari's
Leto was
end
not
up
just
singing?
Acting on screen, but also singing on the soundtrack? Think about how great it would be.
Okay, if this is a movie about the Jared Leto character being instantiated into the real world and discovering Depeche Mode and then starting 30 Seconds to Mars, I'd like that movie.
Think about how great that would be.
Don't you think that seems like where it's like Thor Love and Thunder, right? It's like this is going to be like the Taika Waititi, like Tron 4. This is what's going to happen. Ari's is going to go on his
Tron 4. I've seen the box office.
Arius is going to go on his walkabout in Italy, and then he's going to start 30 Seconds to Mars. We all know where this is going.
It's I do love that they tease a fourth film in this franchise at the end of this movie by showing us a photo of two characters from Tron Legacy, as if A, anybody remembers who those characters are, and B, as if anybody cares about what happens to Ares. And see, as if this movie wasn't always destined to gross like $80 million at the domestic box office, because sometimes people are like, why do you talk so much about business on the show? You talk about the business of Hollywood a lot on this show. You know, you should just talk about the movies. And like, you can't understand why a thing gets made unless you understand the business of why it gets made. And the business case for Tron makes some sense. We can discuss it. We'll discuss this on the bonus episode. But there was no universe in which this movie was going to be a big hit. The fact that Disney spent $180 million on it is corporate malpractice. It should not exist. It should not exist. I
agree with this, but I would push back just a little bit. A good director could come up with a reason why it should exist. And this movie is not well directed. It is not well written. It's not well directed, and it's not well edited. But this is this movie's reason for existing is the original Tron is loved by some people, including me. And even more than that, the original Tron and Tron Legacy have an incredible design aesthetic. And this is the thing that I was thinking about as I was coming out of this film, was how many of these sort of strange IPs that just won't die, that they keep making another movie in, that they keep bringing back. Even some of these films, okay, you can understand why they're being brought back. There's obviously even a big market, something like the J.J. Abrams Star Wars films. But so many of these Hollywood production, these big budget Hollywood productions for IPs that first came out when we were kids or even before any of us were born, the design work was incredible. And people remember how good that design work was. And that's why these movies are sticking around, why they keep making more of them. It's because of the design work. And it's a real shame, because think about in the last 10 years, the last 15 years, how many movies have had a kind of aesthetic, a design that like is going to live on, and people are going to want to come back to that 30 or 40 years from now. I can think of maybe a few, but it's not a large number, because so much of the kind of design talent, and this movie, like I said, often looks good. But so much of the production design, the effects design, the costume design talent in Hollywood right now is devoted towards recreating something that came out in the 70s or the 80s, not making something new that 30 years from now, people will want to look back and say, that was awesome. Let's do it again.
Yeah, this is the pinhead effect. This is the pinhead effect, because like there's a double digit Hellraiser series, because there was one good costume design in the movie Hellraiser like 40 years ago. And so now we have 15 Hellraiser movies because there's a guy that had pins in his face one time.
So now we get a movie that looks like, where all the action scenes look like really high tech, like artistic glass blowing or something.
Yeah.
Right. It's like all right. It looks like is like molten glass everywhere. Maybe I'm just wrong.
All right. Maybe. All right. What do we think?
Light cycles. The light cycles were so cool that people can't stop making movies about them 40 years later.
Save it for the bonus episode. All right. What do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Tron Ares? Peter.
Thumbs up on the Nine Inch Nails soundtrack, which is awesome. Thumbs down on this terrible movie.
Alyssa.
Thumbs down. It's awful.
Thumbs down. It's not good. Not a good movie. All right. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to you, our subscribers on Substack. Tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. And if we don't grow, we're going to die. That threat is getting more real, guys. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at Sonny Bunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. Or you can complain to us in the comments here. That's fine, too. See you guys next week. Or on Thursday, if you're a subscriber, at movieisle.substack.com.